Three, please. United States versus Hill and King, please. All right, you can proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Tina Schneider. I represent the defendant, Henry McKee. The first issue I'd like to discuss with the court is the one concerning prosecutorial misconduct. That is that the prosecutor repeatedly asked the defendant on cross-examination whether other witnesses had lied, and then in closing and rebuttal closing argument.
I'd like to have a little enlightenment on that about asking these questions. And I know that other cases make that statement, although most of them say that it's harmless or something in disposing of the case. But why is it prejudicial to the defendant? The question is just, isn't your testimony contradicted by the testimony of other witnesses? Certainly not trying the defendant isn't prejudiced by some suggestion that the government witnesses are liars. I just don't understand the logic of
okay.
this situation.
I think that there are two reasons why this is so bad. The first is that it is the jury's obligation.
I understand that, but suppose you've convinced the jury that the government witnesses are liars. Why is that
prejudicial
to the defendant?
It also suggests to the jury that they have only two choices. When testimony conflicts, that is to say one witness is telling the truth and the other is lying, or the first witness is lying and the other is telling the truth. The jury may not want to reach the conclusion that Sharon Hunter, the leasing agent, this nice woman, would lie. There's another option for the jury, though, that line of questioning suggests isn't an option. That is, that Sharon Hunter or any of the other witnesses were mistaken. And not that they were purposely lying, but they were mistaken. And the jury has the right to conclude that it's rejecting part or all of a witness's testimony because the testimony is not accurate. Not that it's a lie necessarily, but it's not accurate. And here what the prosecutor asked was not, are you saying that the testimony of these other witnesses is not accurate?
Well,
because that would be okay.
Forgive me, but I mean, the government has conceded error. So we really need to talk about is
the effect
why
of that error.
Why it's
That's
not,
right.
Why
and
it's not harmless. Although I did have one question, and that was on the two or three occasions in closing where the prosecutor said, I believe or I think, would those objections, in your view, still be objectionable if the prosecutor had left out those two words?
That's a very good question. And if it was just in passing an occasional I think this or I believe that, it probably wouldn't, it would be not a good thing for the prosecutor to have done, but it stands in stark contrast with this case where the prosecutor repeatedly said, gave his own personal opinion. The prosecutor said, the thing I find most offensive, now there's no way that can just be a comment on conflicting testimony, that is the prosecutor giving his opinion on the veracity of the witnesses. And to get back to Your Honor's earlier question, the government has conceded that the questions on cross, compelling the defendant to comment on the veracity of other witnesses was error. They attempt to minimize that error in a few ways, none of which work. First off, they contend that the questions only related to minor details of the case. Well, the questions involve, number one, rental of the safe house by my client. this was so important that the prosecution mentioned it 3 times in its opening, including telling the jury that the safe house was very important to the case. The government mentioned it, discussed it 4 times in its initial closing argument and 5 times in its rebuttal closing argument.
Wasn't the evidence against your defendant so overwhelming that it, no, regardless of what they asked?
Oh, no, Your Honor.
It wasn't.
No.
What about all of that surveillance tapes?
There were tapes. There was only...
How do you overcome all that?
Because as the defense argued,
voice right on it.
As,
what are you saying?
As the defense argued in the closing, it was all subject to different interpretations. And what the defense was, yeah, I came to the hotel room to pick up these two women and bring them to another hotel. I did it as a favor to my friends. I didn't know about the drugs and whatnot.
Oh.
The testimony itself...
But the jury didn't buy that, did they?
The jury didn't buy that.
No.
But the jury didn't buy that in the context of a trial where the prosecution did several things that were conceitedly error and very prejudicial to the defense. The other issues on which the prosecution compelled the defendant to call other witnesses liars concerned testimony of a government agent, and there's case law suggesting that it's bad to compel one witness to call another witness a liar. It's especially bad where that other witness is a government agent who carries with him the prestige of the government, who has maybe a higher credibility in the eyes of the jury, even though that's not how it should be. That's how it is, and as a practical matter. And so in doing your assessment of the prejudice to the defendant, the fact that the prosecution compelled him to call the government agent a liar is even more important. Finally, the government concedes that the questioning concerning a purported earlier meeting, an August meeting between my client and the co-conspirators, was important. But they assert that the jury was presented with a clear conflict between the testimony of the defendant on one hand and the testimony of several other witnesses, including the co-conspirator, on the other hand, about this earlier meeting. And that's just wrong. The co-conspirator, Judith Rumjuk, or however it's pronounced, was the only witness who testified about this earlier August meeting. Then the government goes on to argue, well, this line of questioning, while wrong, was just a way to point out a contradiction and not meant to solicit an opinion on the credibility of these other witnesses. But that's absurd, because what the government did was ask the question to point out the contradiction and then follow it up with a question asking the defendant whether that other witness was a liar.
You see that you're into your rebuttal time?
If, with the court's permission, I'll just keep going and give up the rebuttal time.
That's fine.
The government argues that the defendant had already implicitly called these witnesses liars. They point to nothing, and there is nothing. There was certainly nothing in the direct testimony indicating that the defendant was calling anyone a liar. Finally, the whole problem with that line of questioning was it forced the defendant to characterize these other witnesses as liars. It took that decision out of the jury's hands. And that problem was compounded by the closing argument where the government repeatedly called the defendant's testimony lies without in many cases pointing to specific parts of that testimony that it alleged was lies.
But you could have answered that, couldn't you?
The defense could have answered...
If you wanted to, if it was that important at that time, you had an opportunity to answer that.
the defense counsel below had an opportunity, but then the government, in its rebuttal, just ratcheted it up. And instead of stepping back, what?
Isn't that common sense?
You mean as a strategic matter?
Yes.
It may be.
And if you were in the other shoe, you would have done the same thing.
Well, I don't want to go that far. But in any event, just to wrap up, although the comments and the closing, the comments made in closing and the questioning of the defendant are looked at kind of in isolation, when we throw them together, they're looked at in isolation to determine whether they were improper, and the government concedes at least part of it was improper. But when you put it all together, what happened was my client was denied a fair trial, and we'd ask for a remand. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your help. All right, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Nasser-Weiss. Turning to the arguments that the defense counsel raised, I'd like to first point out that there were no objections at trial, so both of these issues regarding cross-examination and closing arguments are reviewed for plain error only because they were forfeited.
Could you talk louder, please?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. First, regarding the cross-examination of the defendant, there's no plain error in the prosecutor's cross-examination of the defendant. As Your Honor pointed out, the prosecutor was merely pointing out contradictions in the testimony. The questions constituted only a small portion of the entire cross-examination.
I'm going to stop you and do and kind of ask you exactly what I asked Ms. Schneider. Because, first of all, I want to congratulate the government for confessing error. It's a refreshing change from some of the things we sometimes see. Secondly, I guess we just ought to talk about what your best evidence was, other than the evidence that really was tainted by that line of by the line of questioning.
Yes, Your Honor. I do think that the record reflects that the defendant was convicted by the jury based on the overwhelming evidence at trial, not because of any line of questioning by the prosecutor. Specifically, there's the testimony of the leasing agent who rented the defendant the apartment to house the couriers, the drugs, and the money, and she testified that the only furniture in the main room was a mattress. We have defendant's post-arrest statement where he said he came to the hotel to pick up the girl and take her to the Red Roof Inn. We have consensual calls between Rimwick, who is the cooperating courier, and a co-conspirator in the Netherlands. And during these conversations, the consensually recorded phone calls, the co-conspirator in the Netherlands, Xavier McNack, indicated to Rimwick that the defendant would be driving her the drug, which she called the stuff, and the other courier to a second location that day. We have the video and audio tape, which showed the defendant opening up the bag of ecstasy pills, taking one out, sniffing it, asking if it was better, and then telling Rimwick, the courier, that she needed to keep her hotel door locked. We have the testimony of the surveillance officer, who watched the videotape as it was happening and observed the defendant pick up and examine the bag of drugs. There's also the package of approximately 11,000 ecstasy pills recovered from another courier on the day before in the airport. There's a loaded semi-automatic handgun recovered from the unlocked glove compartment of the vehicle the defendant drove to the scene of the arrest. And there are travel and telephone records reflecting travel to and from the Netherlands by the co-conspirators and communications between the defendant and the co-conspirators. In addition to this overwhelming evidence, any effect of the questioning was modified by the court's instruction to the jury regarding its role as a fact finder.
You know, in one of the footnotes to your brief, you stated that you were moving to supplement the record with certain transcripts and a videotape. Has the record been supplemented?
Yes, Your Honor, it has.
Okay.
So, in conclusion, this challenge questioning did not constitute plain error. looking to the closing arguments, again, this was forfeited and is reviewed for plain error only. And the government counsel properly commented on the credibility of the defendant and the defense witnesses based on the evidence and the reasons.
Well, the problem was he did it a little bit excessively, didn't he? He did it, what, 11 times or something like that?
I mean,
wasn't that piling on?
Your Honor, I believe the prosecutor may properly comment on the credibility of the witnesses as long as those comments are reasonably based on the evidence adduced at trial. And here, the defendant put his credibility at issue by testifying at trial. The evidence demonstrated that.
But have we ever said that 10 references weren't excessive? We've given prosecutors a pass for 3 or 4.
Your Honor.
10? What's going on?
I'm not sure if it happened 10 times, but I'm not aware of a case that puts a number limit on the amount of times. In fact, there are cases out there that say that the prosecutor could have, in fact, labeled the defendant a liar, and he didn't even go that far. He just said the defendant lied and pointed out contradictions in testimony.
I'd like to ask you a question about the gun. Judge Moran, when he was discussing this, seemed to apply the clearly improbable standard, which applies to whether the gun was used in connection with a drug crime. But I thought the real question here was possession, wasn't it? I mean, did this fellow know that there was a gun in the glove compartment? The judge conceded or he felt the gun, there was that proof that the gun belonged to his wife. So I'm not sure that was adequately shown.
Well, Your Honor, there is a two-part test. First, the government must show that by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant possessed the firearm.
Now, that's what I think is in question here, to my way of thinking. Is he in possession just because it happens to be somewhere in the car that he's driving? Is that?
Your Honor, and constructive possession is sufficient, which means that.
Well, you've got to have control, though, to have constructive possession. You can't. Just because you're near the gun doesn't prove anything unless you have to know that it's there and have some control over it.
That's right, Your Honor. And I think the evidence showed, at least circumstantially, that the defendant knew the gun was there and he had the power and intention.
Yeah, well, what's the evidence? That's, I think, what Brother Cuddy's getting to.
Yes. Well, the gun was in the car. The defendant drove the car to the hotel where he admitted he planned to drive the couriers to another hotel. He was the sole occupant of the vehicle. He had power and control over the entire vehicle and its contents. It was accessible both to the defendant and to the couriers. The defendant frequently drove the car from everything from grocery shopping to clubbing. The glove compartment was unlocked. And regardless of who owned the car or the gun, the evidence showed that the defendant constructively possessed it. In fact, the only evidence to the contrary is the defendant's own self-serving statements where he said that his wife owned a gun and where he said that he did not know it was in the car.
Yeah, Judge Moran said, I'll concede that it was his wife's gun or something to that effect.
That's right. I think that it was reasonable for the district court judge to accept the circumstantial evidence of the defendant's knowledge over the defendant's self-serving statement.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd kind of like you to comment on Ms. Schneider's argument that the credibility of a government agent is more likely to lead to a miscarriage of justice than asking about the credibility of other witnesses. How would you respond to her argument?
Well, I did review the case cited by appellant, and I do believe that that case did say that or cited cases that said that. It was not a Seventh Circuit case. But in this case, the questioning regarding the case agent was not critical to the case at all. The questioning to the case agent, regarding the case agent, the question was, when you're arrested, you told Agent Coleman that you and Remwick and McNack were friends, isn't that right? Those were the two couriers. Defendant answered, yeah, associates, friends, yes. Question, you said the three of you had met and stayed in touch, isn't that right? Answer, no, question, oh, so when he testified that he was wrong, he was lying, answer, yes, we didn't stay in touch. So even if that is to be, even assuming arguendo, that is to be weighed more heavily. In this case, the questioning was not critical at all. It was a minor detail whether or not the defendant had stayed in touch with the couriers Rimwick and McNack. So it's still the government's position that such questioning did not constitute plain error.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel.
Okay. The government respectfully requests that court affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant Henry McKee. Thank you.
Case number 4, please. Taylor versus Federal National Mortgage.